Parshas Ikev. We're really going to skip the beginning of the parsha. We're going to get to Perek Ches. Kol ha-mitzvah shanochem. We're going to come back to it. Kol mitzvah shanochem mitzavach ha-yom. Tishma l'asos. Every mitzvah that I command you to do, you should keep and do it. L'an tichyon revisam v'vasam v'risham z'aretz v'nishpash l'al mosdechem. So that you will live, you'll become great, and you'll go and you'll inherit the land that Akadosh Baruch Hu swore to give to your fathers. Later on it says, v'ya'ancha, that God afflicted you, v'yarivecha, and he starved you. This is the line over here. And he gave you his food, the man that you've never known, you've never heard about before, nor did your fathers ever know about that. In order to tell you that a person does not live on bread alone, rather you live by the word of God. Now question, what was the man like? The man was bread, wasn't it? I mean, what bracha did you make on the man? That's a good question. Tommy Menhagim says, you say, Hamotzi lechem min hashamayim. Instead of Hamotzi lechem min haaretz, you say, Hamotzi lechem min hashamayim. It's bread. Just it's bread from the heavens instead of bread down here. So you make a hamotzi, it just goes the other way around, right? It goes that way. So what does it mean? So you're eating the man so that you know it's not that you live by bread, you live by the mouth of God. No, we're eating by bread. It's just bread of shamayim. So that's question number one. Why does it say it that way? Number two, it seems that all of this was a test that you should know. In the pasuk before it, it says, "Lenasoska," you were given this man, almost you were put in the desert to afflict you. What kind of a test, what kind of an idea of a test or affliction were we trying to go through for the men for? We were willing to do what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, and we came right after Mitzrayim. You'd think that we'd be all into these things because we knew what God could do from what we saw by the Mitzrayim. Why was this such a problem? So the Ksav Sofer, again, the Ksav Sofer's son, gives an amazing answer. We all know that Dor Midbar lived awesome lives. They didn't have to plow, they didn't have to reap, they didn't have to plant, they didn't have to do anything. They got everything for free. They wanted water, you had Be'er Shel Miriam, and it tasted like any water you wanted. You wanted food, you had the mun, tasted like anything you wanted. You wanted protection, USV 40. You wanted some type of something that would protect you from the sun, from the snakes, from the scorpions, from everything bad that's out there. You had it. It was all there. They had protection from absolutely everything you could imagine, from the clouds. Everything was there. So they had more time to do what? So what do you guys do? If you have everything taken care of, and everything's fine, so what do you do during that time? You learn. Is that what we do? You have a Sunday where you don't have to worry about going to work. You don't have to worry about doing this, that, and the other. So are you sitting and learning all day? Bnei Yisrael had no excuse for 40 years. 40 years. They were expected to work on their souls. That's what they had to do. And they had to learn all day long for 39 and a half years. And that's exactly what they did. Says the Gemara, Lo nitna Torah elo la'ochle aman. The Torah cannot be given to people who are working all day. Because if you're working all day, you have no ability to sit down and really enjoy the learning that you're doing. It's almost like a requirement. You've got to go right after your work and go and learn something. You can't do it. You need the years where you're off from everything else, where you have the ability to sit and learn. That's what you need. You need those years to be able to learn it correctly. And then things come easier as time comes, as time goes on. If you're already trying to learn, if you're starting to learn for the first time when you're working, it can be done. There's no question it can be done. But it's a lot more difficult because you're in a different world already. If you're married and you have 7 kids and then all of a sudden you're getting up there and saying, you know what, I think I'm going to start learning now. It's not going to work that easily. It's not going to come to your head so easily. This is the idea of what Chazal was trying to say from over here. And the reason their bread came from Shemayim was to test them. What was the test? Are you going to make use of your time wisely or no? Are you going to do something good with your time or not? What is Bnei Yisrael going to do in the Midbar? And those that did bad things were killed off. Those that did it correctly and learned for those 39 years got to go to Eretz Yisrael. Kadosh Baruch Hu saw that they were ready to go into it and they were ready to be in there. The truth is, we obviously know we weren't created to be doctors, lawyers, accountants. It's funny. I gave a zoo tour yesterday for a bunch of young professional Jews at Lincoln Park Zoo. About 25 guys altogether. I don't think there was a single guy that wasn't a doctor, lawyer, accountant, or actuary. One guy was unemployed, but he should have been one of the four. It was that can't be our only purpose. There's got to be another purpose, and it must be there's something else. they're supposed to be to concentrate on what you're supposed to do for the next world, and then do what you need to do in order to live in this world. The Torah comes first, and then everything comes. It would be so much clearer if we had the same lives that they had. We can't, but we have to concentrate as much as we can now while we're still younger, and we still have that chance before we get out. And that's the concept of what we're saying over here. This was the test. They passed it, but there were people that didn't. There are people nowadays that don't, and that's the concept. Now, it seems a little strange, though, and there are some things that are just very off. I mean, are they really going to have the problem here? After seeing all the crazy miracles out of Mitzrayim that came out, are they really going to think that they don't want to do everything? I understand the Yitzhar was tremendous, and I understand sometimes it's really, really hard to do. I understand that. That makes sense. But could they not think, did they not have any problems? I can't understand what in the world they could have had an issue with that really bothered them so much. So Chassam Sofer said they had a big issue. When was the last time? Well, I mean, everybody knows that Bnei Yisrael knew all the stories, right? We knew what happened with Avram Avinu, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. They had all the stories down. What happened to Avram Avinu when he was told by God to go to Eretz Canaan for the very first time? What happened to him? Went down to Eretz Canaan, well, it might be the second time. What happened to him? He went down there, and what happened? And there was a famine. And what did he do? He went down to Mitzrayim. Did God give him the man? There was nothing. So when God told them to go down the desert, were they guaranteed that they were going to get food? No. In fact, it might be even worse. Avram Avinu only had 318 servants, plus his wife, plus Lot. That's it. He had to feed 321 people. Okay, granted, that's hard, but 321 people altogether, right, is not that hard in comparison to 3.6 million people. 3.5 million people are going into a desert, and they're not guaranteed food. Avram wasn't given food, and he's a huge tzaddik. How do we know that we're going to get anything going into the desert? Says the Chassam Sofer, they had a legitimate complaint. They went in anyway. They were praised for doing such a thing, but they didn't know. They had no idea what they were going to get, and that was the test. Are you going to go in even though you're not guaranteed anything? It's possible you'll get nothing. It's possible you'll end off starving and begging me for food. And yet still, they went out without any problem whatsoever. So that begs the question. Why wasn't Avram Avinu given the money? Why wasn't he given money? Why did he have to go down to Mitzrayim? Why didn't Avram Avinu get the money? Isn't that a simple question? If Bnei Yisrael got the man, and they're not as great as Avram Avinu, then Avram Avinu went to Eretz Canaan. Shouldn't he have immediately gotten the man from HaKadosh Baruch Hu so he could stay in Eretz Canaan? Why didn't he get the man? And don't tell me so we could go down to Mitzrayim so that Sarah would be taken by Paro. That's ridiculous. Why didn't Avram Avinu ever get man? If he was told to go down, why didn't he get it? The answer is, he couldn't get it until he was tested and passed the test. Avram Avinu passed the test. His children knew that Avram Avinu passed the test. He was willing to go down even though he wasn't given anything. And Bnei Yisrael went in knowing they probably wouldn't get anything, and then they were able to get the man. Man doesn't come for free. We never get anything for free. The fact that we have bathrooms that work, the fact that we have sinks that run, the fact that we have toilet paper, the fact that we have everything that we do, which we take for granted completely, because if anybody has never used if you haven't had this chus of using toilet paper before, the first time you see it, I imagine would be the greatest miracle of your whole life. Right? Going into it, nothing comes for free. You always have to give up something. And this was what it was. In order to get the man, they had to go in thinking they were going to starve, thinking that they had to do something when they get out there in the desert, and then HaKadosh Baruch Hu was willing to do it. Avram Avinu didn't get the man so that his children would pass the test and get the man. That was the concept of what it was. And that's the idea of, we don't live on bread alone. We live in the mouth of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we do whatever we can in order to get around. Let's go another way around, okay? Aaron dies, and it mentions it in this week's parsha, right next to him, Perek Vav. I should say that, and Perek Yud, and Pasuk Hey and Vav, mentions one after the other that Aaron died. Right before it says, I came down from the mountain, Moshe Rabbeinu says, but also Mr. Lukos, but I put the Lukos in the Aaron that I made. They were there like Hashem commanded me. Which Lukos were these? Obviously not the first one. Those first ones were broken. The second one. Were the second Lukos as good as the first Lukos? No. What was the difference between them? I'm sorry? see through them. That is somewhat true, but both luchos.
Moshe
made the second ones. The first ones were made by God. What was the physical difference between the first luchos and the second luchos? It was able to float in the air the entire time without Moshe Rabbeinu holding it whatsoever. Moshe Rabbeinu had to grab them and throw them down to the ground in order to break them. Otherwise, the luchos were floating. But aside from that, you could not forget anything from the first luchos. If we would have received the Torah from the first luchos, if that would have come down to us, nobody would ever forget their Torah learning ever. Second luchos, there's forgetfulness. That's what the idea of the cracked luchos are. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu broke the luchos. Right after that, it says, "Va'efan ve'irid." It says, "Bnei Yisrael nasan viveres bnei Yakam Moseira." Sham meis Aron yikaver sham. Aron died there in Moseira. What's the connection between the Aron Kodesh being broken and the second luchos being given, and then Aron HaKohen going ahead and dying? What's the difference between those two? So Chazal talk about this. It's an easy answer. Just like God is angry about the luchos having to be destroyed, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is upset. He gets angry that a leader has to pass away. Now we have to understand something about that. Why do we cry when a great man passes away? Something like Rav Eliashiv, something like Rav Kaduri. The Gemara tells us that whenever a great gadol dies, HaKadosh Baruch Hu always makes sure that the next leader is right in place. Somebody is there to take over. I don't know who that is every time. I don't think anybody really knows. But there's always somebody. When Moshe Rabbeinu passed away, there was Yoshua. When Aaron HaKohen passed away, there was his son. Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. That was quick. Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. You always have somebody who's able to take over, right? There's always somebody there. So if you have a leader that's taken over, then it's good. We're okay because we still have a leader. And Aaron went to a better place. He went to a place where there's no pain, no problems. It's Gan Eden. There's only good things up there. Why is that a problem? Why is there something bad about a gadol dying? We should praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Every time a gadol dies, he gets to be in an awesome place, and we get another leader that's just like him. Why wouldn't we be happy about that? So the answer is, it's also something simple. We all know that, was Yeshua the same level as Moshe Rabbeinu? Yoshua was considered like the moon to Moshe Rabbeinu's son. Was Elazar the same thing as Aaron HaKohen? Obviously not, right? Elazar is no way going to be the same way as Aaron HaKohen. Were the second luchos the same thing as the first luchos? Absolutely not. Guys, we go down every generation. No matter how great somebody from the last generation was, he was never as great as the previous generation. I just think of the people. In our last generation, we had Ramosha Feinstein. Does anybody compare to the amount of tshuvos that Ramosha Feinstein wrote and the amount of kulas that he was able to find for Klal Yisrael? Does anybody compare to anything that he did? Go to the generation before that. Was anybody like the Chazon Ish? And the fact that he was able to understand everything in Torah as well as try to convince the scientific world about things that they weren't convinced about? And then go back another generation. Is there anybody like the Chafetz Chaim? Anybody ever exist that was like the Chafetz Chaim? If you keep going back, you're going back to the Chassam Sofer, Rabbi Akiva Eger, the Gra. Is there anybody like him? Let's go further back. Is there anybody like the Rambam? Like Rashi? Like Rabbi Yochanan? Rabbi Akiva? These guys don't exist, and nobody took over for them, no matter how great Reb Meir or Rebbe Yehuda or Rebbe Elazar were. Nobody was as great as Rebbe Akiva. And I don't care how great Reb Moshe Feinstein's Talmidim were. They are not going to be Reb Moshe Feinstein. There's always Yeridus Adoros. There's something that happens after the first one. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu gets upset about. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't get upset. There's no way that a God can get upset. But it's a different world. Broken luchos means we're in a different world, and God is upset that we couldn't survive in that first world. So too with the Gedolim. When Aaron passes away, there's no one that can take over that's going to be on the same level. And that we're upset about. How could it be that there's not going to be anything there? Now when Luchos is written, it's written in a way that's written without a vav. Lamed, vav, ches, sof. Without a vav at the very end, so it's written without that vav itself. To tell you, they were both equal. Okay, you ready for a little bit of a cheshbon? You ready for a little bit? You're going to have to use your brain just a little bit. I'm sorry, Shmuley, just for 5 minutes. I promise you, it won't be anything more than that. But just to have a little bit. Why were the Luchos written without a vav? To tell you that they were both equal. Both sides of the Luchos were equal. That's a problem. What was on the first side of the Luchos?
First five
of the Aseret Dibros, right? What was on the second part of the Luchos?
I have no idea.
Take a guess. The other five, right? You'd think that would be it. That was a hard one. very hard, right? It's clear, by the way. I mean, it's not lo sesis. If you think about what's the first, okay, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, lo yelech Elohim acherim al panai. That's I am God. Don't bow down to idols. Lo sisa. You can't, obviously, you can't use my name in vain or whatever you want to call it, right? Shabbos, keep it out the aim. Those are the five on the first side. All of them are dealing with bein adam lemakom between a kodesh baruch hu, except for maybe keep it out the aim. But even that has shaychus to Hashem. Last five: don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't kidnap, don't bear false witness, and don't covet. Awesome, I gotta love that word. All those five are on the second one, which obviously deal with Adam Lechaver, right? That's only one opinion of the Gemara. The other opinion of the Gemara says that all ten were on the first Luchos, and all ten were on the second Luchos. Now, if the Gemara is telling us that they're both equal, then that's a problem. Both equal means there's ten on one side and ten on the other side. It can't be five and five. It's got to be ten and ten. Ten on both sides, and that's how it's got to be written. Otherwise, they're not going to be equal. You're going to have different words. You're going to have different lettering on both sides, and that's going to be problematic. Okay, if that's the way it's supposed to be, then I've got a problem. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu break the Luchos? What did he learn it from, and how did he get it? How do you understand that he was supposed to break the Luchos? He came down from our Sinai, looked at the people, and he said the following. He said, if these guys are willing to do Avodah Zarah, then they're willing to do any Avera in the world. If they're willing to do any Avera in the world, then they can't get the Luchos, because the Luchos of every mitzvah. So he took the Luchos, and he destroyed them, because he said they don't deserve any of the mitzvos. They deserve to have absolutely nothing. He made a Kal Vakomer. If they're going to do Avodah Zarah, they're going to be over on absolutely everything. So he broke them based on that. But that's only one opinion, that if you're a mummer for one thing, you're a mummer for everything else. If you see a guy that's worshipping Avodah Zarah, do you automatically think that he's going to steal? Do you automatically think that he's going to commit adultery? Do you automatically think that he's going to murder somebody? Maybe you. Most people. You don't. The guy could worship Avodah Zarah, but he could be a really nice guy. Most opinions of the Gemara deal with the fact that if you're a mummer for one thing, you're not a mummer for anything else. You're just a mummer for that and not anything else. So you can only break one ruach. If there's five and five on each of the Luchos, Avodah Zarah is only on one of them, but not on the other one. So if he came down and it was written five on one side, five on the other side, and he came down and he wanted to break them because they were worshipping Avodah Zarah, according to the opinion that you're only over on one of there, you're not over on all the others, and he could only break one Luach and not the other. But if there's ten on one side, ten on the other, then he could break both, because both of them have Avodah Zarah on them. Here's what Moshe Rabbeinu was doing, and this is what the Pasuk is telling us. Our whole childhood is an absolute lie. Everything that you were told, that there were five on one side and five on the other side, is an absolute lie. It cannot be. Because if that were so, then Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't have broken both Luchos. He only would have broken one of them. The fact that he broke both of them means that it must be that the Aseret HaDibros were written on both of them, which means that when they committed Avodah Zarah, he was willing to break both of them, because both of them had Avodah Zarah on them, and because Avodah Zarah was on them, and they worshipped Avodah Zarah, they didn't deserve to have the Luchos, which means that there were ten on both, which means that the Luchos were equal. How is the Luchos written in the Pasuk? It's written without a Vav. Since it's written without a Vav, we see that they're going to be equal to one another, and that's the concept behind it. See that I'm losing you on this. I'm going to go a little bit easier now. Okay? That was a little bit hard. You came after work, and like, your heads are all completely gone over here. How is Uz Yashar written in the Torah? If you look in the Torah and you see Uz Yashar, how is it written? The spaces, right? But how is it written? It's called brick upon brick. You have one line, space, one line. Then the next line is little line, big line in the middle, little line. And then again, space, line, space, line. And that's how it goes all the way through, correct? How are the B'nai Haman? How are the B'nai Haman written in the Torah itself, in the Megillah? How are they written? One on top of the other, right? All the way down, right? And we say the S, etc., the S, etc., Dalia, Ves, Vaizosa, etc. All the Aseres B'nai Haman are written that way. What's the difference between the two? What's the difference that Uz Yashar is like that? So the Gemara answers the question. It says, Shelo Tehe Lahem Tekuma. So the B'nai Haman can never climb themselves back up. The problem is the following. It doesn't say Shelo Haya Lahem Tekuma, that they never got up. They should never get up again. I don't get it. They're dead. What does that mean, that they'll never get up again? How could they get up again? Why is it in future tense? Why is the Gemara telling it to us in future tense? I'm sorry? Tchias HaMesim is interesting. You think the B'nai Haman are going to get there for Tchias HaMesim? It'd be really strange that our Kodesh Baruch Hu will bring back a Molech and they try to kill the Jews after Tchias HaMesim. The Gra asked this question on Purim. The Gra didn't drink on Purim. The Gra didn't do anything. The Gra asked that question on Purim and asked everybody there. The Chai Yodam, everybody knows who that is? Rav Avram Danzig? He was there at the meal. And the Gra answered the question. He said, if you look at Perek Yud Aleph Pasuk Dalid in this week's parsha, you'll understand it. Now let me read you the pasuk, okay? Vasher Asa Lachel Mitzrayim L'Susa L'Rechbo. God did this to the armies of Mitzrayim, to his horses and to his chariots. Sher Hitzif Es Mei Yamsuf Alpneim. He made the Yamsuf go over their faces. Berud B'Machrayim, when he chased after you. Vayabdeim Hashem Ad Yom Hazeh. And God destroyed them until today. Said the Gra, if you understand this pasuk, you'll understand what it means by the Aseres B'nei Hama. So the Chai Yadam looked at the Gra and said, I don't get it. Chai Yadam's not a stupid guy. Chai Yadam's a really, really smart guy. Looks over to him and says, I don't get it. What are you talking about? What did that mean? How can you say Ad Yom Hazeh? So what do the words mean, guys? What does Ad Yom Hazeh mean? Until today. If they're dead, the Mitzrayim are dead. What do you mean they're dead until today? That what? They were going to come back? They're going to have Chiyas HaMeisim, as you just said? Gilgulim? Is that what we're talking about? What does Ad Yom Hazeh mean? What does God mean? And it's a straight up pasuk. God destroyed them until today. What does until today mean? It should be God destroyed them, period. Chayyadam said, I don't get it. So the girl looked at him and said, how do you not get it? It says chariot, right? So the Chayyadam says, now I get it. Do you guys get it now? Chariot? Nothing. Okay, I have no clue either. Okay? The chariot is a reference to the angel of that nation. Here's the deal. Vayar Yisrael es Mitzrayim meis al Sfasayam. B'nai Yisrael saw Mitzrayim dead al Sfasayam. Tell me, if you wanted to say it in plural, what would you have said? Vayar Yisrael es
Mitzrayim
meisim al Sfasayam. But it says Mitzrayim meis. Why is it Mitzrayim meis? Every nation of the world has a malach. Egypt has a malach. You know what the name of the malach is? Rahav, also known as Mitzrayim. If anybody was at Rabbi Cohn's Shabbos Hagabal Drasha, Rahav. This is the Malach of Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim was also its name. Vayar Yisrael's Mitzrayim Meis Al Sfasayam is that the Jews not only saw the Egyptians dead on the bank of the river, they saw the Malach of Mitzrayim, known as Mitzrayim, dead on the banks of the river. They saw an angel dead on the river. Now, guys, how does an angel die? How can an angel die? He's not a physical body. Angels cannot die. So how does an angel die? How can it be destroyed by a Kadosh Baruch Hu?
Mitzvah with his mission.
But that's not death. That ceases to exist. How can a malach die? The answer is, no more Kedusha. A malach only lives from the name of El that is in its name. For example, what's the famous malachim that you all know? Michael, Gabriel, Raphael, Uriel. There are some that have a different name of God known as Pon. Sandal with Pon at the end. There's also Metat and then Ron at the end. It's Metatron for those who were wondering where Transformers got the name from. It's close enough. There are those that come one after the other. They have Shemos of HaKadosh Baruch. When the name of God is taken away from that Malach, the Malach no longer has any Kedusha, cannot get up again, and it is dead forever. When Mitzrayim, the Malach of Mitzrayim, was destroyed, he was destroyed in a way that the shame of Hashem was taken away from the Malach, so that he could not move. He physically will not and cannot get up ever again. The Malach of Mitzrayim was dead on the banks of the river. And he was gone forever. He will never come back. Ad Yom Hazeh means, granted, people can die and they won't come back. But the Malach can come back. Rome can always come back because the Malach of Rome is still around. Greece can still come back because the Malach of Greece is still around. Duvia was the name of the Malach of Greece. The Malach of Persia can still come back. They're all still around. Those Malachim are still here. They can always come back. But Mitzrayim is dead. Any semblance that you see among the Egyptians today is not the same Malach of Mitzrayim. It's the Malach of Kush, because the Kushim came up and took over Mitzrayim after the Mitzrayim were destroyed. It's a different Malach. It's not Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim is absolutely dead. So here the Gra makes it understood. If the Malach of Mitzrayim is dead, it's that the Mitzrayim will never get up ever again. Now you can understand what happened to Aseres B'nei Haman. By Haman and Amalek, were all the Amalekim destroyed at that moment? When Mordechai killed Amalekim, were they all destroyed? No, right? Amalek still lives today, and there still are Amalekim. Remember, the Chassam Sofer one time was walking away from Yeshiva. I'm sorry, walking to Yeshiva, and some kid threw a rock at him. So the Chassam Sofer picked up the rock and threw it right back. Chassam Sofer was a kid at the time. He was 14, 15 years old, nailed the kid in the head. He came back, saw his Rebbe, Reb Nachman Adler. Reb Nachman Adler was an awesome mekubel. Looked at the Chassam Sofer and said, you did a mitzvah today. You have an otherworldly glow. So he asked him about his day. He finally found out that he had thrown a rock at a kid. He said, that kid must have been Amalek. And you killed Amalek. So we're not allowed to do that. But the fact is, if you do kill an Amaleki, right, that is an otherworldly glow. You were zocha to a mitzvah that nobody's able to do. That was a mitzvah right there. Amalek is still around. So the line that's used by the Gemara and the reason why the Aseres B'nai Haman are in this order is not that they didn't have a tekuma. It's that they should not have a tekuma. Because Amalek still exists and we don't want them to become strong again. And they were written in that way so that they'll never be strong ever again. That they should never have that tekuma. And it's funny, because the Gra used to say that Nazi Germany was Amalek. This is obviously, the Gra lived in the 1700s, right? He obviously did not know about Nazi Germany in the 1900s, in 1933 when Hitler came into power. But he always said that Germans, and specifically said Aryans, no offense Tal, but specifically Aryans, were supposed to be from the seed of Amalek. And that does explain a lot about you, but it, regardless, they're supposed to be from the seed of Amalek. That might not be, it might not be an exact quote, it's not necessarily the Aryans that are involved, but he did say that Germany was the seed of Amalek. That Germany, Germania, is how he put it, and it's referring to that area of Germany. That's what the girl said. Okay? Now listen to this very carefully. The Nazis, Yimach Shemam, after they were all caught, there was a famous story, and maybe this will be able to help. We all know about the Nuremberg trials, right? The trials that happened at Nuremberg where they caught 10 of the most famous Nazis, that really 11 of the most famous Nazis that they could find, and they were all tried and sentenced to death. One of them, who was it? It was Goring, had killed himself the night before. See, he wasn't going to be hung. He just committed suicide. The other 10, right, were hung that day, as in the Aseres B'nai Haman. The funny thing about them is that there's a simple reference to it within the Megillah itself. Sometimes you might have seen it before. There are small and bigger letters within the Aseres B'nai Haman. Certain letters. And the certain letters that are there, this is in 1946, right, 1946. The letters that are there, does anybody know what the year would be? Well, we're now in Tav Shin Ayin Gimel. So that would have been Tav Shin Vav. So the letters that are big are Tav Shin and Vav among the Aseres B'nai Haman, among those 10 people that were hung. There were 10 people hung. One of the last one to be hung was Julius Streicher. Streicher, I don't know how he pronounced his name. Julius Streicher, when he was being hung, called out loud, Purimfest, 1946. Purimfest, 1946. And that's a connection to Purim. The Aseres B'nai Haman, a simple reference. The fact that Amalek can never get up again is what stopped the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, from taking over the world. The reason why the Aseres B'nai Haman are in that row is that somebody like the Nazis, Amalek will never be able to get up again and do anything like they once did before. It will never happen ever again. That line is based on that. So maybe there's a connection between all these things together to explain what the Groh is talking about. We're going to end up with this one thing. The Ben Ishchai asked a simple question, and I hope you guys think about this question. I hope you've asked this before. Ben Ishchai asked, why is it that every time we're given a bracha, like in the beginning of the parsha, we're told you're going to have rain? And every time we're cursed, God tells us, you're not going to have rain. We say it, right? Yore u'malkosh. What's yore and malkosh? Early rain and late rain. Very good. From Tinus, right? You're going to get rain if you're good. You're not going to get rain if you're bad. Good and bad. Good and bad. Why is it always rain? Why is rain the only way around? The Ben Ishchai says, crazy Kabbalah, and I'm going to initiate you just a little bit. What are our lives about right now? Our lives are about finding Kedusha in the most unkadosh places, grabbing them for ourselves, and using it to make the world kadosh. Eventually, when the world becomes so kadosh, then Mashiach is able to come. The world has the ability to be so holy for Mashiach to be there. Every time a person does something wrong, that takes away that Kedusha. But our point is to bring about more and more Kedusha, to bring that Kedusha more and more over. There's a problem. Kedusha can be in plants. So that's easy. How do you take the Kedusha out of plants? You eat them. Right? If it's in grass or herbs, what do you do for those? animals. You did not just say that. But animals, you should know there is a famous Belshazzar about that. I was not going to go with smoking them. No. Animals eat them, and then you eat the animals. And you get the Kedusha that's inside the animals, as well as the Kedusha that's inside those things. There are certain animals that you cannot eat because their Kedusha is so deep down, it's impossible for a normal human being to get it out. So there are certain things that you just can't get out. You can't get out of a camel, can't get out of a pig, can't get out of any of those animals that are unkosher. But what about rocks and dirt? How are you supposed to get the kiddush out of that? Nobody eats dirt. So how are you able to do that? What do you want? Throw it on a malik. No, that's not the answer, though. So how do you get the kiddush out of that? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu did an amazing thing. He allows the rocks and the dirt with rain to be able to make the plants grow. And the nutrients, which is the kedusha of the dirt, goes into the plants, which is then eaten by either human beings or animals. Without a Kadosh Baruch Hu involved, we would have no way of being maila that kedusha and bringing that kedusha back. But because God gives us rain and lets it rain and allows that water to come up, we have the ability to bring it up. And not only that, there's a Gemara. For every tefach of rain that comes from above, two tefachim of water come up from down below. Meaning, it's not just the dirt on top that gets the kedusha out. The dirt on the bottom as well pushes its kedusha up through that rain that comes from the bottom, or the water that comes from the bottom, that allows the kedusha to help the plants grow, that brings the kedusha into our bodies by either eating vegetables, which I don't suggest unless there's salad and there's nobody else there because you don't make friends with salad, or by any other type of animal that you eat that eat from the grass, you're able to bring up that kedusha. That's the only way of doing such a thing. Without rain, you wouldn't bring up the kedusha, which means Mashiach can't come. So the biggest curse in the world is not letting it rain. The biggest bracha in the world is letting it rain and taking in that kedusha. That's why it rains. When it rains, instead of looking at the world and saying, I hate rain, I despise rain, I wish it wouldn't rain, think to yourself, this is what brings the geula closer. It's the honest truth. That's what brings the geula closer, and that's why we fast for rain. That's why we get so involved in our tefillahs in rain. That's why it's so important to only ask for rain at certain times and not for others. That's why it's such a machlokas what you do in South Africa, for goodness sake. If their rainy season is the opposite of Israel, what kind of rain are we dealing with? Who cares? It's just rain, and we have irrigation systems anyway. We got irrigation systems throughout the world for the last 1500 years. Because rain makes everything work. It brings up water from the ground that brings more kedusha from the ground, from the dirt, into the grass. And that's the reason why it's so special, says the Ben Yishai. Top of that, guys. Have a great Shabbos.